Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again at long last by Matt Kinnear, and we are talking fall ball. Matt, there's an argument to be made that fall is the most wonderful time of the year. How are you doing?
I love it. It's the, you kind of get this like front seat, all access pass to all of this awesome lacrosse, and no one really seems to realize it, but it's just so cool. It's, you know, getting to see the teams in their formative kind of, you know, anemic state is really awesome. And then, you know, we just get a front seat, and there's still so much like awesome lacrosse that happens, even though it doesn't mean anything in terms of win and loss record. It definitely means a lot in Memorial Day. You know, what you see in the fall really is the beginnings of what you're going to see Memorial Day weekend. So awesome time of year. And the weather's great too.
Did you used to use the word amoebic?
I did.
Was that like on a page a day calendar that you recently saw, or like on a screensaver? How did you pull that one from the recesses of your memory?
I don't even. So that's where I pulled it from in my memory.
There you go. You were an amoeba the last time you heard that word. That's fantastic. Yeah. No, I mean, I'll just echo a lot of your comments. The one thing that really comes to mind when I think about fall is time, and how much that is the opponent to coaches' plans, and that in the fall, it's the surplus, right? You have nothing but time. There's no urgency. There's no game that's either, you know, 3 days away or 2 days away or 1 day away that you feel like you need to get in everything that you want to be prepared for. And so as a result, you know, things just move at a much more casual pace. And I think we saw that even this past weekend at US Lacrosse for the Fall Classic, USA Lacrosse, excuse me, with respect to the fact that the men's national teams aren't going to be competing until 2023. It's the fall of 21. You know, for the women's team, maybe a little bit more urgency given that their world championship is only a year out. But at the same time, I didn't feel like there was, you know, so much pressure on the Canadian and American men's and women's senior teams that they needed to like get something out of this weekend. It felt like it was a opportunity to compete, get back together for the first time in a long time, and kind of start to learn who they are.
And time, that's an interesting, you know, observation, because it provides another coaching challenge in its own way in terms of what do you do with this time? You know, having
how do
no
you
time,
not waste your team and players' time?
Yeah, exactly. And I think this fall, you know, I've seen and talked to a few coaches who've kind of gone in like divergent directions, where there's some who felt like there was, you know, so much ripped away last year that they're trying to do as much as possible this fall in terms of public scrimmages and, you know, get as many games as we can out there and do as much as we can. Whereas there's a few others who I think saw last fall as kind of a blessing in disguise, in the sense that they didn't need to worry about the scrimmages and, you know, trying to compare themselves with other teams when they could just kind of work on themselves. And, you know, one example that I use is Rutgers, a team that has had a lot of scrimmages in other years. This year, they're doing some red-white scrimmages, and they're doing their own thing. But they made a conscious decision of like, you know what? Last fall was really good to us. We got to learn about ourselves. And that's what they're doing this fall as well. You know, it's a team I'll go see this week at practice. But, you know, interesting how you manage all the time that you do have, especially in a year following, you know, what was so varied so much from team to team and conference to conference in terms of the amount of time that they had in the fall, if they had any time. So that's just another, you know, way that the coaches can put their impact on their team is how they make the most out of this session here.
So let's just start by giving the listeners a little bit of a glimpse into who we've seen. So I went to Johns Hopkins practice on October 1st. That was the first of the fall practices that I went to. Kind of felt like the transition from September recruiting into focused on college fall ball for the month of October. And then subsequent to that, I went to Georgetown and Yale. And then the weekend after I went to those two teams' practices, I went to a play day that featured Loyola, Delaware, St. Joe's, and Villanova. So I've seen those seven teams live. Who have you seen?
So I was with you at Johns Hopkins. We went to that practice. Then I, the next day or 2 days later, went to Virginia. So I saw them on a Monday morning. Then I've also seen Penn live in person at practice. and I'm trying to remember all these here. Been to Gettysburg, the D3 team with Peter Toner taking over that historic program. Then I've seen some fall ball events, the first of which was the one down in Northern Virginia benefiting the American Boy Project. That was Lehigh, Virginia again, Penn State, and Richmond. Then this past weekend, another fall play day event at Boys Latin here in Maryland, where I saw Drexel and Towson from the CAA, and then Lehigh as kind of a repeat team. I saw them in back-to-back weeks. And then Princeton, you know, their first time having some intercollegiate competition in a really, really long time. So those teams kind of all played each other. And then a few teams on tap, but that's where I'm at right now. That's about, I don't know, 10, 11 teams I've seen so far.
Yeah, I think we've got a representative sample of college lacrosse. And I think that, you know, we've seen three Ivy League teams. I'm gonna see Harvard later this week, and you know, we'll figure out what the remaining Ivy League teams, whether or not we can get to them before the fall is done. But by virtue of having been to a Yale and Penn practice, and you're having seen Princeton scrimmage, you know, we're talking about teams that, with very minimal exceptions, such as you went to Penn playing Cabrini last spring. It's been since March of 2020 since most of these players and teams have been seen on the field. What was your takeaway from going to practice at Penn and seeing Princeton this past weekend?
Yeah, it's, you know, if anyone thought that the Ivy League was down, you know, I do not think that's the case whatsoever. Granted, I think there might be a little bit of like that first game back, a little bit of shell shock or something, but these teams are really, really good. I think across the board in the Ivy League, people are going to be surprised at the number of really talented players that are back that they either just forgot about from not seeing the past year or didn't realize were buried kind of deeper on their roster and hadn't gotten playing time yet. You know, the Ivy League is, you know, going to have several teams that should be in the preseason top 20, and I think going to have several teams that end in the, you know, final top 10, you know, with at least one or two kind of final four contenders in the mix there. You know, I think, you know, the death of the Ivy League was premature. You could see that in terms of the class of 2023 recruiting and how well those teams are doing in that regard. But seeing the teams on the field, you know, they are legit national contenders right away. And it's really exciting to see how good those teams are and how they haven't skipped a beat.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think it comes from two directions. So the first is that a lot of these teams had coincidentally cycled up for the 2020 season. You know, obviously Penn and Yale were coming off of an incredible quarterfinal matchup in 2019. You know, Princeton had gotten off to an undefeated start and beaten Virginia. And Cornell was off to a very, very hot start as well. And Michael Sowers, Jeff Teat, Jackson Moreland, Matt Gaudette, you know, the list of really good players, you know, from Penn, Sean Lully having transferred to Duke, and Mitch Bartolo having gone to Rutgers. You know, the number of very good players, and I'm remiss not to mention, you know, last year, Cal Thornton having gone to Notre Dame. You know, like the list of very good players who were on the
field.
You're
forgetting TD. That's how good of a list it is.
Exactly. There you go. But the list of very good players who would have been on the field in 2020 and 2021 that are not going to be back for 2022, it's legit, right? Like, we understand that there were missed opportunities as a result of those seasons having gotten taken away. And then the other side of the coin is kind of what you were talking about, which is, you know, this notion of recruiting and the seriousness with which Ivy League presidents or athletic directors take athletics, because they allowed the 2021 season to be canceled, and that high quality recruits weren't going to choose to go there because, you know, they'd been shown that that sports don't matter to those places. And to your point, I think the amount of talent that I saw at Yale's practice in conjunction with, you know, how well these teams are recruiting show that both of those proclamations were a little bit off the mark. So, you know, for me, going to Yale was really interesting because more than anything else, I wanted to get a sense of what does this practice look like compared to the unknowable counter reality where they had played a 2021 season. And the only thing that I can really base my expectations off of was having gone to practice in the fall of 2017. And that was 4 years ago. It's hard to remember. But at the same time, I have this one incredibly overriding memory, which is they beat the crap out of each other. And that wasn't nearly the case at the practice that I went to, but I learned afterwards that a big part of the reason was because the coaches had told the players, like, you got to take it easy a little bit. You're going too hard after each other and somebody's going to get seriously hurt. So I'll file that away as, you know, potentially a coincidental whatever. But as far as like the actual rustiness is concerned, it didn't look any rustier than Georgetown or Hopkins. And, you know, obviously seeing games is a little different from seeing practice, but, you know, the four teams that I saw on that play day. So what was your opinion of just kind of the skill level rust that may or may not have accumulated among these, specifically Penn, when you went to practice?
Yeah, at Penn, I was shocked that there was little to no rust, to be quite honest. And, you know, part of that is Penn is unique in the sense that they were practicing a ton. You know, they practiced all spring, basically, had the one game against Cabrini. So, if anything, their sticks should be, you know, among the sharpest in the country, because that's all they've been able to do is, you know, stick work and practice drills and stuff like that. So, I was really, really pleasantly surprised about how good their skill work was in terms of their, you know, conditioning. In fact, they kind of felt fresh when you talk about conditioning, the overall athleticism, you know, strength training, all of that stuff. You know, it really almost felt like a revitalized Penn team in a lot of different ways. So I didn't see that, and I've seen other practices, and, you know, again, it is the fall. We haven't gotten to the real cold weather yet, but teams are going to be a little bit rusty. If there was any of that at all, which I didn't see, that's just the norm. It wasn't like, oh my gosh, I haven't touched the stick for 2 years. What's going on here? These are still high-level players who know what the heck they're doing.
Who stood out?
Well, first thing I'll say about Penn, and I use that term revitalized, you know, I'm going to go in a weird direction here, but you know, in The Grinch, when, you know, after The Grinch takes all the toys and he's listening to hear, like, everyone, he's listening from atop the mountain and they're all singing. That was kind of like what I felt like. I was like, going into this practice thinking these guys are going to absolutely hate practicing because that's all they've done for the past 18 months is practice, practice, practice. But it was just like so much. They were laughing. They were having a great time, full of energy. It was very joyous. So, you know, it was like, you know, I was like the Grinch, like, oh my God, like, you know, they were singing, you know, I can't believe it. So that was my first like broad impression of Penn. But when you go to practice, you can't help but notice Sam Hanley. Obviously, he's a giant, but he had the ability to take over practice. And I mean that in the best way. That's not saying that everyone else was not good. He just was, you know, if he needed to just use his brute force to kind of get to the net, he could. But most of all, I was really impressed with how he shared the ball with everyone. He just has this great ability to kind of just suck in the whole defense and get it to these great Penn shooters. The guy who I think people don't realize how good he is, and he's kind of been, you know, buried behind some other guys at Penn, is Jack Schultz. And, you know, he just had this kind of lefty low to high shot from the wing that went in every time. And I was talking to Coach Mike Murphy after the practice, and he said, hey, do you know what hand he is? I presumed he was a lefty, but he's a righty and just has that shot. He's so two-handed that he's going to be kind of unstoppable. And then, you know, in the goal, Patrick Birkinshaw, he's a guy that, again, people didn't really get to see a lot of him. He was on that Virginia National Championship roster, played in 2020 for Penn, but that was only a handful of games and, you know, just learning a new team and learning all of that. But he looked phenomenal in practice, and he looks like he can be a game changer from the net. So, all in all, great team. Dylan Gergar is another guy who he had an awesome game against Cabrini when they played last spring. He's still on the roster. So there's a lot of guys on this team. You'd be surprised at the number of players. But Sam Hanley is a legitimate, you know, I'll go as far as to say he's a wartime capable player.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that sounds right. You know, there's nothing about that that's surprising. And it's to your point about great players that are easy to forget about, you know, he's at the top of the list. He could mm-hmm. be arguably the best player in the country. And there aren't a lot of folks that are thinking about him as, you know, in that category because he didn't play last season.
And remember, he missed most of 2020 because he ruptured his spleen.
Right.
Too. So we're really far off from seeing him, you know, in his best form.
So at Yale, it's interesting because, you know, I think it's fair to expect Chris Brandow to be the best offensive player. And I think that, you know, by and large, that gives you the sense that he'd be the best player on the team. But he's not, like, the most vocal leader. So he doesn't have, like, the most commanding presence at practice. I would say that their midfield group really kind of carries that mantle. Brian Tevelin is a solo captain. You know, he was a contributor on the national championship team. He had an incredible story during the 2019 season. He has an incredible personal story overall. But it wasn't just him. You know, the D-Mitty crew in particular really brings a lot of vocal leadership. And then, you know, I was impressed by defenseman Chris Fake, who was obviously a burst on the scene as a defensive player of the year type player in 2018. And at that point, it was really kind of like he had a Revis Island type quality to him, you know, C-man, lockdown man, or C-ball, get-ball type situation. Mm-hmm. And I could really, you know, kind of feel his presence more strongly in practice overall. I think that they're going to be pretty deep offensively, surprisingly so. I do think that, you know, there'll be some spots that are contested for. And I think Leo Johnson, the Under Armour All-American, is going to bring a unique dynamic to the lefty attack spot. But I think it'll be hard to keep Will Cabrera off the field as well. I think that they have enormous shooters from the midfield, guys like Logan Solberg and Christian Kropp, who didn't practice because he withdrew this fall in order to be able to come back in the spring. And, Patrick Hackler and you know, a couple others that have veteran experience that I think are going to be really good. But, you know, kind of top of the roster to the bottom, or at least top of the depth chart to the bottom, you know, I think Yale's going to be pretty good. The biggest difference, obviously, is that they can't expect that they're going to win 70% of their faceoffs. Now, that being said, you know, Joe Newman was, if memory serves correctly, a number one rated faceoff recruit in his class. And then in James Ball and Mac Rodriguez behind him, they've got two other really highly regarded faceoff specialists. So I do think that there is going to be an answer there for that group. It's just a question of, do they win at 53%? Do they win at 60%? Or do they win at 68%? And, you know, the delta within those increments can be the difference in, are they the number one best team in the country? Are they the fifth best team in the country? Or are they the 11th best team in the country? So they've got some questions to answer, but not as many as you might expect for a team that hasn't played a game in 20 months, or it will have been more than 20 months by the time they get there.
Yeah, and faceoffs is a good kind of parlay into the next team that I want to talk about in the Ivy League specifically. It's Princeton. And, you know, Princeton was interesting because Michael Sowers was such like a dominant force and, you know, on the field, but also just in terms of, you know, he's the player that you think of Princeton. Everyone's like, oh, that's Michael Sowers' team, and didn't really think of anything else beyond that, for better or for worse, you know, whether that's fair or not. But, you know, faceoffs have been kind of an issue for that program in general for a long time. And Kobe Ginder, who, you know, again, another really highly touted faceoff guy who we haven't gotten to see. He was awesome this past weekend, you know, in the scrimmages against Towson and Drexel. You know, I believe he won the first three against Towson, three in a row, and probably finished, you know, by my guess, somewhere around 70%, maybe 75%. That's a huge, huge piece for the Princeton Tigers. And, you know, they're a team that's kind of built the opposite of the Michael Sowers era. They have these enormous, really talented defensemen, you know, George Bond, you know, as one of them, Ben Finley, Song is another guy who's a really awesome defender. They got these really tough midfielders who are extremely athletic and can score. Jake Stevens is someone that, you know, I know you saw on Friday night when he played for Team Canada, and then I saw him the next day when Princeton played against Towson and Drexel. You know, he gets everything ground ball wise, but, you know, he can put the ball in the net. I think he had two or three goals in the Towson scrimmage. And then attack is a bit of their weak point right now. You know, I think they're still figuring out who is the guy, and that's something that's going to happen when you graduate a talent like Michael Sowers. So they're going to be a Princeton team that's really good. And net, you know, they seem very good as well. Eric Peters got the start in the game that I saw. And then Mike Gianficcara, am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, Gianficcara.
He's, you know, he played a stretch as well. And they've got about, you know, three goalies that they feel really good with. So, you know, maybe the areas that were weaknesses for Princeton, you know, over this past stretch are now strengths. And maybe the parts that you perceived as, like, you know, oh, this is the Michael Sowers team that can, you know, score 20 goals in any game, but they're going to give up 17. You know, that's not necessarily the case in this year's Princeton Tigers team. But, you know, really impressed with them. This was their first time playing anyone in, you know, 18 months. Rutgers in 2020 was their last game that they had. So there was some normal, you know, shooting the ball a little too much because they're just getting a little over anxious. The defenseman just kind of wanted to take some guys out every once in a while, as opposed to, you know, playing solid defense. But, you know, that's the stuff that you kind of want to see as a coach, as opposed to the, oh my gosh, I haven't played, I'm going to sit back and be a little, you know, lack confidence in my game because I haven't played in so long. So really impressed with them. And, you know, haven't seen Cornell, haven't seen Brown and some of those other teams, but I think you can definitely make a case that they are in that top three, maybe top four of the Ivy League, and, you know, going to be a team that can be, depending on how, you know, things shake out, they could be a top 10 team by the end of the year.
I'll take a wait and see approach on that one in particular, but understand where you're coming from for sure. Another team that I want to talk about is Georgetown, because you spoke earlier about the diverging priorities or ideas around using fall ball time. And when I came away from their practice with was this notion that they hadn't had a fall ball in the fall of 2020. And so their players in relatively small groups played a lot of like 2-on-2, 3-on-3. And they felt like it really benefited their IQ development and their skill development just in terms of learning how to play. And so they really emphasized that throughout their fall practice. It was pretty obvious to see, actually. One of the things I went with Dan Kaplan, our coworker, and one of the things that he said leaving the practice was they didn't do a single second of 6-on-6. Now, they did, it was really, you know, like an hour and 40 minute practice, and they did a ton of either, you know, even man, odd man, and, you know, kind of cycled up from, you know, 1-on-1s all the way up to 5-on-5s. But, you know, even the simple fact that they didn't do a settled 6-on-6 drill is indicative of a shift in, I don't want to say their program in particular, but just generally how teams regard, you know, this is what we're trying to do. I mean, you play the game 6-on-6, so obviously you got to emulate it in practice. And, you know, clearly Coach Phipps, Coach Warren, Coach Shriver, Coach Rowlett have different opinions as to the value of that with respect to, like I said, developing skill and developing IQ. You know, as far as the guys who really stood out to me, TJ Haley is so much bigger than he was last year. It's outrageous. And I learned after I wrote the article that apparently he lost a ton of weight leading into his freshman year. And it wasn't intentional, so I don't know whether he was sick or dealing with another type of issue. But, you know, he's basically back to the level that he was expected to be at. And we're talking about a guy who put up 49 assists as a freshman and only scored 5 goals. And, you know, the big kind of theme for Georgetown is if he can turn the corner and consistently produce, it's really dramatic relative to the amount of gravity, the amount of space that all of his teammates get in terms of their step down shots. So, you know, if the idea is how are we going to replace Jake Caraway's 50 goals? Well, you're probably not going to get 50 goals from somebody who didn't score a goal last year, but maybe you can get 10 additional goals from 5 guys. Or
Maybe you can get 30 additional goals from Dylan Watson, who looked absolutely unbelievable. And then you only need, you know, 5 additional goals from Haley and Bundy and Hess and McDermott and your other known quantities. But in addition to that, you know, had my eye on Connor Morin, the grad transfer from Notre Dame. Certainly had my eye on Will Bowen, the grad transfer from North Carolina, the defenseman, and then Alex Trippi, his teammate as well. And, you know, my takeaway was that those guys are still kind of settling in. I think that there's probably some pretty substantial differences between how Carolina plays versus how Georgetown plays. And, you know, they're just kind of getting their sea legs, so to speak. You know, in full candor, I don't know why I didn't know who was coming back and who wasn't coming back for Georgetown, but I didn't expect to see Gibson Smith there. And the fact that he was, I mean, his presence is palpable in terms of, you know, what he means to that defense with respect to ending possessions, whether it's causing turnovers by picking the ball out of the air or an incredible ground ball, and the way in which he can organize the defense, truly a special. Owen McElroy, the goalie, is back, and he was probably the best goalie in the country last year. So, I mean, like the Yale practice, didn't see Georgetown do anything competitively facing off. So, obviously, that's a really important part of the game that I can't really speak to when it comes to what I saw from the Hoyas. But they look like a serious team to reckon with, and a team that has significantly increased their strength of schedule. I believe they open with Penn, and another indication of how good they think they are.
Yeah, it's funny, though, when you mentioned, like, oh, I didn't realize this guy was on the roster. You know, it's going to be like this for the next few years as well of, you know, guys' academic situations, their, you know, their redshirt situations are all a little bit, you know, difficult to read sometimes. You know, Gibson Smith coming back again. When you said that to me, I also did not realize that as well. So, you know, him coming back, you know, Georgetown's, you know, I'd say a top five team heading into the 2022 season. But there's another guy that, you know, and I knew he was back, but, you know, number 2 overall NLL draft pick, Ryan Lanchberry.
Yeah.
I watched Richmond and I watched them play. They played in the series of the event that I went to. They played against Penn State. And they played against Lehigh. I didn't see the Lehigh game, but, you know, the score was pretty indicative. They kind of rolled Lehigh in that game, and they got out to a big lead. Then I saw them play against Penn State, and, man, Ryan Lanchberry is really, really freaking good. Like, he's the player who I most came out of this, you know, this half of fall. You know, I obviously, you know, he's a good player. You know, he's, you know, one of those also-con type guys, but man, I came out of this being like, man, he could be one of the best attackmen in the country. His ability to, he just kind of makes that like east-west pass through the defense, and you just never know what's coming. And you know it's coming, but you just don't know what's coming. And he does it every time. And Richmond moved the ball on offense as good as any team I've seen, you know, this fall. It was just really, really impressive. And, you know, they kind of rolled through Penn State and, you know, had a pretty big win against Lehigh in that event. I'm going to see them again this coming weekend because they're going to be at the Headstrong event in Baltimore. So definitely keep an eye on Richmond as a team to watch. And, you know, Lanchberry is, you know, obviously he's number 2 pick in the NLL draft for a reason, but his ceiling in 2022 seems to be, you know, wherever he wants it to be.
Yeah. Continuing on with, you know, teams that we came away with strong impressions of, you know, for me, at that Loyola play day, the two strongest impressions were Loyola's ball movement offensively and Delaware's energy. I was really high on the Blue Hens last season because I watched their win at Drexel very closely, and I think that that made them 5-0, and maybe that was their high watermark. Well, no, it did make them 5-0 because didn't they lose their early game against Mount St. Mary, but that was maybe like their fourth or fifth win in a row to rebound from that after they got their players back from COVID protocols. And so I was really high on Delaware, and then, you know, they kind of faltered a little bit down the stretch, and obviously Drexel won the CAA and put up a really impressive effort against Notre Dame in the first round of the NCAA tournament. But I thought the Blue Hens played with a ton of energy, particularly in the second matchup versus Loyola. But Loyola, I think, outscored Villanova 8-1 or 8-2 in the second quarter of each team's first game scrimmage, whatever it was, at the play day. And during that period of time, there was incredible ball movement from the Greyhounds, really facilitated by Aiden Olmstead and Kevin Lindley, doing what they do. And it was the type of thing that you've come to expect from those two guys, who obviously have been mainstays for the Greyhounds for several years. But I think the addition of Evan James, who appears to be healthy, Joey Kamish out for the fall, expected to return, I believe, for the spring. But then, just a couple other guys that are starting to learn their roles and settle into the offense, particularly Davis Lindsay, an attackman with a really hardcore Canadian skill set, despite being from South Carolina, who missed, if not all, then certainly most of his freshman season due to injury last year. I think the Greyhounds are going to be able to score a lot of goals. And Sam Schaefer, the goalie, picked up right where he left off. I wasn't overly impressed by Loyola's defense, but I do think that there's so much experience there. We know what to expect. And I think that, they're going to win a lot of faceoffs with Billy Savio. So a lot of reasons for optimism from a Loyola team that's a returning quarterfinalist.
Yeah, and sticking in the Patriot League, another team that made a positive impression on me, Lehigh. Like I said, they kind of got, the Richmond game was not their best for sure. But I saw them against Virginia, which is as good of a test as you'll get in the country. And, Lehigh made some mistakes and Virginia just absolutely capitalizes on everything. So, Virginia kind of ended up running away with the game. But, when it got into 6-on-6, Lehigh hung right with them. Tommy Schelling is kind of an elite player there for Lehigh's offense. They're pretty beat up in terms of some of their injuries that they have. So a lot of their – I didn't feel like I got to see their offense in full force. Mule was not there, for example. John Sidorsky, who was a key player last year. But Schelling and then Cole Kirst, and a guy I really, really liked was Scott Cole, who kind of crafty, but just a tough guy who really made some hustle plays. So I really like what I had Lehigh, and also the fact that they bounced back this week from that Richmond loss that we mentioned. They kind of came back and had a really good day against Drexel and against Towson as well. So Lehigh, is another team out of the Patriot League that, I think it's going to be Loyola. Lehigh is kind of the 1-2 in that league, at least my early impressions of them. But Terry, we've talked for about a half hour.
And we haven't talked about the defending champions?
Yeah, we've only alluded to the defending national champion, Virginia Cavaliers, who, I saw in practice, and then I saw their scrimmages that they had against Lehigh and Penn State, and then watched parts of the games against the U.S. national team and the Canadian national team on the LAC Sportsnet broadcast. So, yeah, Virginia. What do you want to know about the Virginia Cavaliers?
I mean, there's a lot. Who's going to be their goalie?
Well, I think it's Bobby Gavin and Matt Nunes are in that battle. Bobby Gavin, I think the thing that's you got to feel pretty good about it if you're Virginia is both of those goalies have looked like starting goaltenders in the games that I have seen. The thing that looking at Nunes, the freshman, the thing that really impresses me is just his confidence. He does not feel like a freshman in net, particularly just his overall net presence and his presence out of the net is something that just feels like a upperclassman would have. So I would maybe give him the edge in terms of his ability to do things outside of the net. But Gavin's been there. He's gotten starts before in his career. He started two games last year and knows the system. And I felt like maybe he was a little bit ahead, at least going into the scrimmages that we saw the past few weeks and then against the national team. So they're in good hands there. And Virginia won a national championship by having two goaltenders who they were not afraid to go to. So if that's a sign of things to come, then maybe goalie controversy is not the worst thing down in Charlottesville.
Right. What about the offense? Obviously, Connor Schellenberger was probably the breakout star of May. Did he look like he was picking up where he left off?
Yeah, for sure. Schellenberger looked great. I mentioned to him that I thought he looked like bigger and stronger, and he actually said that he lost weight and just kind of trimmed down, but just focused like so much on like being as fit as he possibly could. And he looks more athletic, if that was even, you know, not that it was a concern before, but he just looks like he has more of a physical command out there. And the way that him and Moore run the offense is just really something special. And their ability to play, you know, kind of that two quarterback system and both really play off each other, you know, that's a 1-2 punch like, you know, we haven't seen in quite some time. So their offense is going to be awesome. You know, I think it's pretty established that it's those two and Peyton Cormier as their starting attack. But Griffin Schutz, the freshman who's out of Deerfield, he's just an incredible talent that's going to be on the field all the time. He'll probably be running out of the box, technically be a midfielder, but he's going to be kind of their star attackman by the end of his career. He's played both midfield and attack in high school and the club scene, so he's got familiarity with both. He's just a physical force that, you know, he's this giant player who has these really soft hands and can, like, you know, sling it from outside, but also play inside with the best of them. Just a lot of versatility there. But, you know, if you're Virginia, you got two guys who are going to be, I mean, for real, two guys who are going to be in the Tourton conversation on attack, on one attack line with Matt Moore and Connor Schellenberger.
Yep.
So that's pretty incredible. Like, I couldn't tell you who is the better of those two. That's just how neck and neck good they are together. And then you throw in the fact that, you know, folks like Xander Dixon, you know, Will Corey, like you got these other guys who are really showcasing some good stuff this fall. There's a lot of weapons on that offense.
And what about defensively? I mean, you know, whether it was Velociraptors or Condors or whatever other type of giant beast that roams whichever countryside, I mean, you know, they're all 6'7" and can throw down, you know, dunk two basketballs in one jump. What was your impression of those guys?
Yeah, I mean, the size is just, you kind of can't get past that, you know? Like, they're just so big that they take up so much space. I do think that if there is one area that you got to watch for Virginia, I mean, Jared Connors is an enormous loss. And I don't necessarily – they don't have another Jared Connors on the roster. But, you know, I'm not exactly sure how kind of their whole defensive midfield is going to come together. You know, Connors, as much as people maybe attribute – people focus maybe too much on the offensive numbers for LSMs and not their ability to shut down midfielders, because Connors, you know, was a guy who could do both. And, you know, I think that that might be something that they have to work with a little bit. But in terms of their close defensemen – you know, that's, they're going to be in pretty good shape there with their close D. I mean, the Velociraptor, why can't I think of his name right now? Cole Kastner, like, he looks like he's taken definitely a step forward. Cade Sawstead, Ben Ware, Scott Bauer, you know, a lot of, like, they kind of have this awesome group of non-traditional geographic guys who are just these enormous athletes that have really kind of come in and fine tune, you know, the Virginia staff has done just an incredible job of, like, taking these guys who are, I mean, they're not guys who've never played the cross before, don't get me wrong, but taking all of their talent and their ability and fine tuned it to make them extremely elite players. And I think you've got another guy in George Fulton, who's going to be kind of the next in that line in the next few years. He's going to be a freshman on a first year on the roster this year out of Massachusetts. But I definitely think that the LSM and the short sticks is going to be the, like, all right, what do we do here? And, you know, they've got Zinn, the transfer from Johns Hopkins, who hasn't played yet. He's going to be a spring transfer. He can provide some help at the midfield for them. But that's going to be the area that is to be seen when spring comes.
So we've talked for almost 40 minutes and we haven't brought up the Johns Hopkins Blue Jays, who, you know, have one of the most ardent fan bases in the entire sport. What would you like to know about Pete Millman's team?
Is the Johns Hopkins team that you saw at practice the Johns Hopkins team that, you know, had a losing record last year, or the Johns Hopkins team that almost beat Maryland and that beat Rutgers late in the season there?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting way to frame it. And the answer is probably a little bit more the Johns Hopkins team that had a losing record, because the practice that I went to did not have Joey Epstein because of class, or Garrett Degnan, Jack Keough,
and Jacob Angeles due to injuries that had affected them that week. So very limited offensively. And in addition to that, it was a Friday practice. John Gann Jr. and Jamison Castor were both on the road recruiting. So a very atypical practice, but there was a lot of value to be gleaned from it, particularly in the sense that, and you know, maybe didn't necessarily internalize this as much in the moment as I did then going to two other practices on the heels of it, but, you know, just how much Pete Milliman was trying to emphasize to his team their need to learn how to compete at the level that this Division I men's lacrosse ecosystem requires, shows that, you know, there's an ongoing transition that they're not finished with. And, you know, candidly, he would probably make the argument that they've barely even started because of the way that they had to navigate last season. So, yeah, I mean, I think the team that I saw was very much a work in progress.
Now, I'll follow that up with, you know, you've seen a ton of practices over the years. You've seen Johns Hopkins practice with Coach Dave Petromala. Can you put just kind of the listener into the shoes of, like, you know, what is a practice under Pete Milliman like?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that it's hard because a lot of the differences are nuanced and they're really on the margins. And so it's to say that, you know, if you go to a Division I lacrosse practice, it's probably going to be divided up into, you know, 8-minute segments, and there's going to be a lot of odd man activity, and it's really going to emphasize quick ball movement. It's going to emphasize shooting from appropriate spots based on player strengths. It's going to emphasize physicality and competition. You know, the defensive principles that are going to be talked about are going to be similar, and it's going to be about friction and communication and recovery. And so, you know, in those ways, like, all those things were pretty consistent and pretty similar. So, you know, I think that it was the biggest difference is probably how much Pete wants to hear from his players, you know, kind of what their thoughts are. And in addition to that, and, you know, this would echo some of your comments about going to Penn practice and how important it was or is for Mike Murphy to see his players having fun, but just trying to keep the tempo light. So, you know, it's almost trite for how commonly it's referenced, but just having music at practice goes a really long way toward changing the vibe in a meaningful way. And so, you know, that's just one example of, like, all right, in the article that I wrote about it, I really emphasized the importance of their games to one, because on two separate occasions, they played a game to one, and I asked Pete what that was for. And his comment was, the unpredictability of what happens in a game, like, that's what we're trying to replicate, such that, like, you know, it probably won't last forever, because as soon as one team scores a goal, then we're done and we're on to the next thing. You know, it might last 10 seconds, it might last a minute, you know, depending on how things go, it might last 3 or 4 minutes, but it's probably not going to last 5 or 8 minutes. And that being said, you're still going to pack a lot into that, just because, again, you know, the things that happen can't be and aren't scripted, but they are real, and they are things that actually happen in a real game. So, you know, those would be kind of the overarching takeaways that I would bring from this. And again, you know, I have to provide the caveat that there were a lot of important players that weren't there. There were certainly two important coaches that weren't there. But, you know, trying to increase the level of competition, trying to increase the spontaneity, and hearing back more from the players themselves were probably the hallmarks of what felt different with, you know, kind of Milliman's squad.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see them in action. You know, this week I'm going to the Headstrong event. That's going to be at Johns Hopkins. So, you know, there's a number of teams there. Johns Hopkins, Richmond, High Point, Hobart, a few others that I think I'm missing there. So it's going to be a really kind of elite tournament that we're going to see Johns Hopkins. You know, obviously, like you said, one of the most storied teams in lacrosse, and, you know, probably the number one in terms of, you know, what if we post a Johns Hopkins story, that gets read a lot more than a lot of other places. So, you know, very important to our readers.
Yeah. So as we wind this down, who are a couple of teams that we haven't seen so far that you want to make sure we check that box?
Well, I've been doing some emailing about, you know, trying to get up to Syracuse to see a practice under Gary Gate, and, you know, also to see the women's team under Kayla Trainer. You know, not sure if it's gonna be myself or someone else. You know, the only glimpse we've had of them was an intra squad scrimmage that they had earlier in the fall that was paired with their alumni game. So getting a closer look at the Syracuse Orange is obviously going to be a priority for us. I'm going up to Rutgers this week. That's a team that had basically the most successful season in program history last year. This year, they have what we ranked as our best transfer class in the offseason, but they are also missing, you know, a ton of points from that those three attackmen that graduated last year. So really want to get a look at their offense and see how that is progressing and see how those new pieces are fitting in Brian Breck's squad. So I'll be up there this week. And then other than that, I definitely want to see the rest of the Ivy League. And, you know, Maryland's another team that we haven't talked about yet. They're going to be a top five team that is missing the two wartime winner, Jared Bernhardt. Anytime you graduate someone who has that much presence, you know, there's a lot to learn about what the team is looking like now, but they got a lot of pieces there at Maryland. So I want to see the Terps soon.
Yeah. And like I said, I'm going to get an opportunity to see Harvard later this week and hope to make a North Carolina swing later in the month. In addition to that, hoping to talk to some of the head coaches from some of the programs that we won't be able to get to before the fall winds down on this podcast and be able to hear from them how their fall went. Whew. Like we said at the beginning, Matt, it's the best time of year.
Yeah, I mean, it's nothing but, you know, nothing but hope and promise and you know, there's still the clean slate of a whole year ahead. Everyone starts with everyone's 0-0 right now. So there's just a lot of positivity out there.
With that, we want to thank you for checking out this edition of the Inside Lacrosse podcast. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and review. Check out Tari Kane Amiri's podcast with Laura Benner earlier this week. It was quite the listen. Very, very insightful. And as mentioned, we'll be back next week with more Inside Lacrosse podcasts.
Inside Lacrosse podcasts, the source of the sport.